Hello, and welcome to the Back Issue Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayer.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about an older comic book storyline.
In this Back Issue Spotlight, I am joined by Sam, and we're going to be discussing Invaders 14 and 15 from 1975, I think? Somewhere in there. 77, March. No, sorry, March 1977. Sam, how you doing tonight?
I am doing well, John. How are you?
I am doing well. A little confused on my ancient history, apparently. But I had picked these two issues, because it may seem a little random to people, and arguably it might be. But this is the Marvel side of a non-crossover crossover with the Freedom Fighters that happened around March 1977. Now, at the time, the Freedom Fighters had their own book. And over in Freedom Fighters, I think it was 8 and 9, they're all fighting the Crusaders. Well, here we are with the Invaders, who's off fighting the Crusaders. And in each case, the Crusaders are kind of stand-ins for the other team. Now, it's a conceptual crossover. It's not like these are two sides of the same story or anything. But it was a way for the creators to kind of sort of play with the other company's toys and whatnot in a friendly way or what have you. Not the first time this has happened, not the last time this has happened. But kind of a cool concept. So, as we're going through this story, there's going to be some aspects of how well do we know the Invaders, and I'm not going to claim to be a be-all, end-all expert, because I'm not. And how well do we know the Freedom Fighters? Because, again, we kind of sort of have the Freedom Fighters here, although not here, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, okay, I had no idea about that aspect. So that now, okay, at least I'm starting to make connections. When I read this, I didn't know that. It's interesting, this cover apparently is by Jack Kirby, even though none of the rest of the book is. And I was wondering if these were characters he had left over from his World War II days of doing this stuff in the Golden Age.
It's possible a few of these characters previously existed and were used for the stand-ins. Specifically, the Spirit of 76 might be one of them, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I think these characters were pretty much created for this story.
Got it. And Thunder Fist and a few of these seem very much like they could have been.
Well, and I think a couple of them, like Thunder Fist and Tommy Lightning and such, not only were created for this story, but I think this story is their sum total appearances.
Okay.
Now, this story is set during World War II. It's a period piece. It's by Roy Thomas, doing the writing and the editing. And I kind of found that interesting, because it's not often you see somebody writing and editing the same book. And I kind of think division of labor, you're better off having two people do that, but it's Roy Thomas. We'll give him a pass. And of course, about a decade after, well, not a decade after this, geez, only probably three or four years after this, he'd be over at DC doing the All-Star Squadron set in World War II.
Yep.
So I'm assuming he's a big World War II buff, either out of personal passion or occupational hazard, having done enough books there. But I enjoyed his stuff over at DC, so it was fun to finally get around to reading these Invaders issues. I picked up the Invader Classic series of trade paperbacks they'd done. There's a total of four of them. This story is in the second volume of that. Now, they may have also recompiled them into larger trades or something. I don't know. Because I think there's a complete Invaders collection as well. But, you know, whatever. It's reprinted. You can get copies of this stuff.
Well, it looks like this particular run, at least on what I'm seeing, has 41 issues plus an annual?
41 issues plus a giant size, which actually was the first issue. They started with Giant Size Invaders number one, and then went to Invaders number one, then kept going.
Got it. Okay.
And there was also two issues of, I want to say, Marvel Premiere? Yeah, Marvel Premiere 29 and 30 that it crossed over into when they had the Liberty Legion show up.
Okay, and then it looks like they had a four-issue mini-series in the 90s as well.
Yeah.
And then there's a current series.
And there's also probably a series or two in between. I know there was an Invaders Now series.
Oh, yeah, New Invaders 2004.
Yeah.
Avengers Invaders 2008. Okay, yeah, Invaders Now, 2010.
But most of those are contemporary time frame for the most part, I think. This one was set back, you know, again in World War II.
Yep.
So it sets it apart from some of the others.
And again, quite a, you know, like I said, Kirby on the cover, Roy Thomas, Frank Robbins, Marie Severin. This is a who's who creative team as well.
Yeah, it was. Although I've got to say, the art didn't always wow me.
I'm not going to disagree. It reminds me of slightly, and I don't know if they were, it feels like a Golden Age. Bam. It feels like an earlier Silver Age book. This book feels like it could have been from the mid-60s as opposed to the mid-70s.
Yeah, it's one of those that's a little lost in time in terms of the art style, I think.
Yeah.
And it wasn't bad. It told the story well. But am I going to hold it up against Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, George Perez, or, you know, somebody like that? No, not at all. Now, does it feel kind of, sort of like, you know, a Kirby kind of a style? Sure.
Yeah.
You know, and again, it's not bad, but it's something that I think some people would gravitate towards and some people would gravitate away from.
Yeah, I can see that. Like I said, I kind of enjoyed this. It's, yeah, this is fun. This is the type of comics I enjoy.
Now, the Invaders at this point are Captain America and Bucky, Namor the Submariner, and then we've got the original Human Torch, the android version, and his sidekick, Toro, who also has flame powers. Now, a few issues prior to this, Spitfire joined the team. And this story is like maybe her second or third adventure, maybe? So she's fairly new to the team. She is the daughter of the original Union Jack, who had guest starred in a few previous issues. And her origin is not, like, conceptually radically different than, like, She-Hulk's or whatever. Spitfire gets attacked by, I want to say Baron Blood or something like that, a vampire type. Bites her, she's losing a lot of blood, she's not doing well, she needs a transfusion, but for whatever reason they can't just give anyone's blood because of the way it's happening. Her blood's like morphing around or whatever. But it turns out the robotic Human Torch has a blood that's like a truly universal donor. More than just like O that's the blood type that's the universal donor normally? It's even better than whichever that is.
It's O negative, right? Or it's one of them. I don't remember which one it is, but it's one of the O's.
I don't remember either. But apparently this android's blood is even better than that.
Why not?
Yeah. So she gets full transfusion of that and winds up with, like, super speed powers somehow.
Like getting a blood transfusion from Bloodshot.
Yeah, I guess.
Kind of.
I mean, it made more sense when She-Hulk got a blood transfusion from Bruce Banner, the Hulk.
Yep.
She turns into She-Hulk. Okay, that makes sense. But it's not like the android Human Torch had super speed or anything.
Yeah.
But you just gotta run with it at this point, and pardon the pun. But that's why she's hanging with the team at this point. Because, I mean, it made sense to, you know, maybe add a female member of the team.
Sure.
But yeah, she's pretty new to it and stuff. And at this point, the team is spending a lot of time over in the England area, but over the course of this series, they're stateside, they're, you know, in the European theater, they're all over the damn place. They've got one of, I guess, Submariner's aircrafts or whatever that makes pretty good time and stuff, so, you know, they're using that, not as their base, but as their mode of transport. Even though, again, you know, at least half the team can fly, so. But the basic thing here is we get the Crusaders out of nowhere who are kind of doing what I would call hero and run type stuff of, you know, go save the day, say, you know, stay long enough to get credit or whatever, and then bolt. And they're clearly British, or at least they were clearly British to the characters of the thing, because I'll be honest, I hadn't picked up on it from the few lines of dialogue they had. But, you know, if you're going to have somebody protect the King of England, which the Invaders were going to do, and it's either going to be mostly Americans or this new crop of British subjects, well, of course you'd want the Brits to do it. That just makes sense. But the big question is, are these guys on the up and up and stuff?
Of course.
Is an interesting story, particularly in light of the Thunderbolts from, oh, I guess that would be the, what did we say last time, the 90s, 97-ish,
yeah,
thereabouts?
Yeah, something like that, yep.
Which again, bunch of heroic types come in, seem to save the day, you know, get the run of the place, because, well, they're heroes, you know, and then the question was, with these guys, the Crusaders, were they really going to be heroes or not? So we get Dynamite, who's a stand-in for Dollman of the Freedom Fighters, Ghost Girl standing in for Phantom Lady, Spirit of 76 standing in for Uncle Sam, Thunderfist in place of the Human Bomb, Tommy Lightning in place of the Ray, and Captain Wings in place of Black Condor. And I gotta say, you know, these Crusaders, if you know who they're supposed to map to, you can see it. But they're more than just kind of a repaint of the characters.
Okay, wait a minute. What about, who did you say Dynamite was?
Dollman.
Oh, okay. I didn't realize the Freedom Fighters had a character like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, at the time, they got pretty much the full roster of the team.
Got it. Okay.
Now, the thing is, the Crusaders over in the Freedom Fighters, I mean, let's face it. You've got two guys who are human, you know, flames. It's kind of hard to repaint them into anything really else.
Yes.
You know, you've got an aquatic guy, you know, for Namor and stuff, Barracuda or whatever. So, yeah, it's pretty obvious. And then when you go for a blatantly patriotic guy with a shield and his sidekick, it's pretty clear that's Cap and Bucky. So I'll give them some credit here of, you know, Ghost Girl did not look like a dead ringer for Phantom Lady. So I think they did a decent job there. And I would say that kind of held true when, well, I was going to say it held true when the Squadron Supreme originally showed up in the Avengers and stuff. Really, it was kind of the other way around. Those guys were pretty clearly analogs for the Justice League, but the equivalents that were over in the DC side that eventually became the Heroes of Angor were better repaints of the Marvel characters. But again, these kinds of nod-nod, wink-wink, you know, informal crossovers have been done a couple of times over the decades. I think they're fewer and further between these days, but that's not to say they're unheard of. I'd be kind of hard-pressed to name the last major one where, you know, two creative teams on two books coordinated and simultaneously told stories with analogs of the other team in there. The last one I can think of that I thought was pretty interesting was New Teen Titans and the DN Agents. And I'm sure most people didn't even at the time know who the DN Agents were, so the fact that they were pretty clear repaints of them, not a big deal, and probably helped get the DN Agent series some attention it wouldn't have otherwise gotten. But yeah, I thought this was pretty fun, where these guys come in, save the day, you know, take the credit, kind of run and stuff, and the invaders are like, who are they and what's going on?
Yeah, well, and this kind of aerial dogfight and crash bomber sequence is actually kind of fun, too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because there is some action in here, and, you know, a German squadron that's, you know, coming down on this British, you know, bombers team. And so, yeah, there's a lot of kind of cool stuff in here.
Well, and I think that a lot of kind of that World War II action type stuff, it plays well, and I think Roy Thomas has a good flair for it.
Yeah.
You know? I think he does a good job of setting it in the time frame and making it work fairly well. Now, granted, at that point, World War II wasn't as long ago as it is today, but, you know, there's that. So, at the end of this, it was just a matter of the invaders starting to feel or come across as a little jealous or insecure or whatever when these Crusaders are, you know, getting set up to protect the king and whatnot, but they really don't have any specific thing to say, well, they shouldn't be able to do that because well, I mean, they seem on the up and up at this point. So these issues are 17 pages each, and they cover a fair amount of ground, you know, because they've got to set up this other team in this issue, have a couple of action sequences, and it feels a bit fuller than you would think for 17 pages.
Yes. Now, is this Lord, what is this, Lord Fallsworth? Does he predate this, or?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
He predates this in terms of he's been in the last couple of issues.
Okay.
He was Union Jack in World War I, according to what they establish in this series. I'm pretty sure he existed. I don't know exactly when he was created and stuff, but I'm pretty sure he predates this series.
All right, I just, you know, all this could have been backstory or it could have just been made up for this. Who knew?
Yeah, yeah, it does get hard to tell at times. And Union Jack gets replaced at least once after the one who'd been around at this point in the series, and I think there's even a modern-day version. So, again, it's a cool costume, so why not? It would be kind of fun to see somebody in the original Captain Britain regalia, Union Jack, team up with Captain America, either the Patriot or the Spirit of 76, and then go find a few other nationalities to kind of toss in there. But yeah. And that Lord is the father of Spitfire.
Mm, yes. Yeah, okay, that's in here. But
yeah. And that's, of course, why they're staying at that place and using that kind of as a base of operations. Now, when we get to the next issue, because it's, you know, just a two-part story and stuff, as is common for the time, they do spend a bit of the first couple of pages recapping kind of the previous issue or arc or whatever you really need to know to kind of get into this issue. Because no direct market really at this point. People either, you know, kids really either found this issue on the newsstand and had read the previous one if they'd found it, or they hadn't. So the recaps were very much needed. And they do it in an entertaining fashion. It actually, I think, gives a better rundown of who these characters are in this Crusaders team than probably the previous issue did, or at least a more concise version. But at this point, invaders are still, you know, they don't want the king to fall under, you know, any harm or whatever, but they're not the assigned protectors because the Crusaders are, you know, insert typical angst there. And there was also a little bit of a subplot going on with, now that we have a female member of the invaders, well, who is she interested in? Is it Captain America? Is it the Human Torch? You know, because, well, why not?
Well, there's that whole sequence with her dad, and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to have subplots, have them do something other than just go heroing. So, I think it was a little kind of, I want to say cliche or whatever, but, you know, it was fine. I did think it was kind of funny that, you know, we start with the invaders around a table looking over a bunch of maps and stuff, and then when we get to the Crusaders, they're around the table looking at a bunch of maps and stuff, you know, very, you know, parallel kind of, you know, team meeting sort of a thing. What surprised me at this point is they apparently have no earthly idea how their powers work. And I'm like, really? You're going out using them and you're really, you know, not sure what's going on? And it becomes apparent when we meet Alfie, their liaison officer or handler or whatever, that these powers are somehow mechanical or technologically based or something. And he has the ability to disable them. And I'm like, okay, interesting. And this, of course, sets the seeds that maybe the heroes are on the up and up with the Crusaders, but this guy, Alfie, maybe not. Again, not too surprising. The fact that he basically recruited a bunch of people that wanted to do what they could for king and country, but couldn't enlist for various reasons, you know, heart murmur. Or really, that was the only excuse they gave out of the, what, six of these people. But it's like, okay.
Yeah, but, you know, come on, we've seen that before, too, you know, Cap.
Yeah, yeah. So it makes sense. The part I thought was interesting was when Dynamite was, you know, hey, can you turn off my power for a little bit so I can be full size for a little bit? And Alfie just kind of, you know, ignores him or blows him off or whatever and doesn't do that. And I'm kind of trying to figure out what sort of, because Alfie has like, he says it's like using radio technology to turn their powers on and off or whatever. I'm trying to think how that would have possibly worked with Dynamite. Because the Pym particles haven't been discovered by Pym at this point, because I don't think Pym's even born at this point, but, you know, whatever.
He would have been alive, probably, but yeah.
At this point in the continuity with the sliding timescale, yeah, probably.
Yeah.
Probably would not have been old enough to be, have, who knows. At this point, clearly not, but again, sliding timescale, World War II's a lot further away than it used to be. So we get an interesting scene with Dynamite really finding out that Alfie's not on the up and up. And of course, who else can he go to but the invaders? How he knew where they were staying, I don't know. But it really set up the inevitable of, okay, these two teams are going to have to fight. So this was as good a way as any to go do that. One thing I do want to mention is, because I kind of glossed over it, when Alfie was talking with the Crusaders, and they're like, well, maybe the invaders should protect the king. And he's like, nah, look at these photos. Those, I think, were from a previous issue when the invaders had been brainwashed, which is what led to Bucky forming the Liberty Legion to go fight them slash save them and such. So those are legit photos of the invaders trashing some stuff.
Okay.
But that's why Cap's fighting, not that you can really tell it there, but I'm pretty sure that's the Patriot.
Oh, is that who that is? Okay, yeah. I see the stars, and okay.
Yeah, yeah, it's an all-blue photo. It's kind of hard to make out, and I think that's Thin Man above him, and I'm trying to remember who else some of the other Liberty Legion were. Blue Diamond, Red Raven, a couple others.
Yeah, here's what's really... Does yours have the editor's note?
For the true motivation behind these seemingly...
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just interesting that he goes, we'll leave it to you back issue buffs with no actual point of where to go.
Well, this was, I'm pretty sure, from Invaders 5 and 6 in Marvel Premiere 29 and 30.
Yes. I'm surprised they didn't call that out.
Well, but that only would have been, like, well, it would have been a year prior, so, yeah. I got mixed feelings on that. I mean, they should, is what it comes down to.
I don't think I've ever seen an editor's note that went, hey, those of you that go looking for back issues, yeah, if you find it, you find it.
I've seen one or two, actually, in some of the stuff we've done not too long ago.
Okay, fair enough. I don't remember them then.
Yeah, yeah. At least it wasn't as bad as that Spider-Man Fantastic Four story with, yeah, there were clues in the issue. Why don't you tell us what they were?
That's what they were, yes.
Yeah, that kind of annoyed me. So, but, I mean, they set everything up to where we get the big fight between the two teams as they're all, you know, basically trying to save the king from blowing himself up.
Yeah, and this is the part that bothers me the most, and only because, I mean, George VI was real. There's photographs of him. There's obviously the famous radio speech. This outfit is ridiculous and looks nothing like the one he wore in this era.
Okay, I totally believe that.
I mean, he is, his World War II, when you see him kind of in his, he looks like a modern-day naval officer.
Mm-hmm. This looks almost more...
Napoleonic.
Yeah, I was going to say almost Revolutionary War sort of era, almost. It seemed much more theatrical than it needed to be.
Yes.
But
like I said, George VI, not that long ago. We have photographs.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, but come on, it's not like they could look it up at the internet at the time.
Fair enough.
Of course, they had encyclopedias back then that I'm sure would have had said photos, but yeah. And, you know, what were they called again? Oh, yeah, libraries. and we get a, you know, fun fight between the two teams. You know, nothing earth-shattering or whatever, but it was good. And ends when the champagne bottle that the king was going to go, you know, knock on the ship to christen it and stuff gets swiped, thrown out to sea, and it does a pretty big boom. And they realize, oh, I guess the invaders weren't kidding. So...
Oh, my. Maybe their research is better than mine.
Oh, you've just looked it up and...
Now, everything I said is absolutely true. Most photographs of George VI in that era, like I said, modern-day naval officer's outfit. However, the actual royal portrait of him from the era, he has something much more akin to what he's wearing in this comic.
Ah.
So there is an oil painting that, again, if you looked up in an encyclopedia... might have been the picture you saw.
Okay, and I could see where, you know, that was the level of research they did.
Yep.
So, I do find it interesting that once they've kind of dealt with Alfie, or once, I can't tell if it's the Human Torch or Turo who dealt with him, I'll say the Human Torch, all of the equipment and stuff the Crusaders had, of course, is now just not worth, you know, working or whatever, so they just chuck it. And I don't think, really, almost... most of them have never been seen again. I think Dynamite sticks around on and off through a few issues later of the Invaders here. And Spirit of 76, I think, later fills in as Captain America. But that may be kind of a retcon versus, you know, anything else. Well, it was certainly a retcon, I think. But like Thunderfist, Tommy Lightning, Captain Wings, Ghost Girl, I don't think are ever seen again. Could be wrong on that, but they were not, you know, at this point they have no powers, so... why use them again?
Well, yeah, I mean, they go back and they just kind of get the butler. They're gone. What do you mean they're gone? Just that, they're gone.
Well, the ones that are gone are Lords Falsworth, who had been Union Jack, Jacqueline, who was Spitfire, and the diminutive guest, which was Dynamite.
Dynamite, yep.
So that's not even referencing the Crusaders, but yeah.
No. But yeah, the invaders, what happened to them? They just disappeared.
And I don't know when they pick that up in the series, but it may be kind of the next, one of the later, next arcs or something. So, yeah, I thought this was fun. Again, if you realize that these are stand-ins for the Freedom Fighters and stuff, kind of cool. None of the story hinges on that whatsoever.
Yeah, I knew none of that when I read it, and don't feel like I missed much out of it.
Mm-hmm. But again, I always find it kind of fun when they do those sorts of non-crossover crossovers. And it's not like there are tons of them over time, but, you know, it does happen here and there. And I think this, you know, worked well just as an Invaders story.
No, absolutely. And I enjoyed these enough that I read the next few, and they kind of keep going, and we get another character major victory coming up. Adolf Hitler himself appears in an issue coming up. Yeah, I mean, these are just kind of fun World War II stories that I am shocked were written in the 70s.
Well, I mean, this is, I think, part and parcel of Roy Thomas's wheelhouse or whatever.
No.
Having done this stuff over here, All-Star Squadron over at DC, you know, the other thing that was his main kind of go-to area at DC was just Earth 2 in general. Of course, so much of that stemmed out of the World War II period, you know, not a big surprise.
Yeah.
I'd be hard-pressed to name any kind of current creator that has kind of carved that kind of a niche for themselves. Of, like, you know, this era of characters is really, or this time frame or whatever, is really what they tend to gravitate towards, the way that Roy Thomas did with World War II and stuff.
Yeah. We don't get many of those stories anymore anyways. I mean, even the Earth 2 characters, when they show up, very rarely is kind of the war era talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's talked about. It's not really seen, though.
Well, but they've gotten themselves into a bit of a hole over with the JSA and stuff, because they're keeping them around, you know, in the current time frame.
Yep.
Which, you know, back when it was the 70s, okay, they're a little older, fine. Now, being active in World War II and still being alive and walking around, even if you go with, oh, they've aged slowly, starts to be a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
But I don't want to say that they should, you know, take those characters and anchor them back in that time frame and not be able to use them today. It's just, I think, a bit harder to kind of have both sides of that and make it work.
Yeah. Well, Cap, you've got the kind of out of the lost years. And I think it's vital to his character. The rest of them, I'm not. Some of them it is, some of them isn't.
Well, another example of that is the Project Superpowers stuff that Dynamite did that also used a lot of Golden Age characters. And they did a very similar, all of them were kind of put in stasis for a while,
yeah,
and pop out in the modern day. And, you know, at Marvel, that's Cap's shtick. You can't just give that to everybody from that
yes.
period. You know, but what's interesting with the Invaders is Cap was on ice for a while. Bucky was effectively on ice for a while. The Human Torch is an android, so it doesn't have to age, and he was kind of put on the shelf for a while. Namor's been around forever and a day, doesn't really age as the way we do.
Yeah.
So you can have most of the Invaders around present day as they kind of sort of were in World War II. I mean, obviously Bucky's grown up a bit, as has Toro.
Do they still use the Golden Age Human Torch at all?
They have used him in recent-ish years. I'm trying to think where he was last used. And I almost want to say it was in the previous run of Iron Man. He was in something, and he lost his body, was walking around in an Iron Man suit in place of a body kind of a thing for a while, and some stuff like that. But he's been used on and off, you know, for more or less most of the last 15, 20 years or so.
Okay.
I mean, as they brought, like, the Invaders back a few times, he usually shows up there, too.
It's just interesting, because what little I've seen of the Golden Age era, he was more... This look seems much more Johnny Storm than kind of the real Golden Age Human Torch, who seemed more Firebug-like, if I remember correctly.
I don't know how much of the original Golden Age Human Torch stuff I've read.
Yeah, me neither. I just...
Every time I've seen them has been more, you know, Silver Age or Beyond type stuff, and they're indistinguishable.
Yeah.
And I, frankly, kind of like to see this guy sit in for Johnny in the Fantastic Four for a little bit.
Hmm. That would actually be interesting.
Because I think he could actually fit in. They, you know, he'd learn some new tricks with his powers, no doubt. But, you know, he would be a very interesting juxtaposition in place of Johnny and such. So, just the personality differences and stuff, because I think he'd get along fine with the Fantastic Four. So,
yeah.
But yeah, they've reprinted the entire run of the Invaders in the Invaders Classics trades. I'm sure they've collected them a number of other ways as well. So this stuff is not too hard to get a hold of, I think.
Nope, and they're all digital. They're all on Marvel Unlimited, which is how I've been reading them.
Mm-hmm. But this is one of the further back things I think we've read and discussed. I'm trying to think how much we've done that was either mid-70s or earlier.
Yeah, well, we did a Spider-Man from around this era not that long ago.
True, true.
I think most of the rest of the stuff we did was later 70s or more early 80s. It's about as far back as we've gone other than this and that one Spider-Man.
Yeah. Well, if DC ever gets around to putting the Freedom Fighters issues up on their digital stuff so you can get a copy of them, I think it'd be fun to go read kind of, I don't want to say the other side of this story, but the other side of this non-crossover crossover.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be fun. And yeah, unfortunately, I haven't checked in a while, but last time I did, those were not available yet.
Yeah, yeah. Anything else?
No, I think I'm good.
Cool.
The February previews came out on January 26th, and the deadline for preview spotlight number 171 is the morning of Saturday, February 5th. Recording clips for the preview spotlight episodes is easy, and we've got an open submission policy for these episodes. Please send in clips to support the comics you love as often as you can. If you'd like to get email reminders for the preview spotlight episodes, you can join the emailing list on the main page of the comicbookpage.com website.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.